You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 30th of June to the 6th of July 2016. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Chris Havergal and David Matthews and Deputy News Editor John Morgan. There's no escaping the big news of the week, the victory in the UK's EU referendum for the Leave campaign. There are, of course, huge implications for HE. We can but scratch the surface of those in this podcast, and we'll do so in just a second. And if you stay tuned till the end of the podcast, we'll have all the news from the THE Asia Universities Summit, which took place at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. But first, John, as I say, there's no escaping the big issue. It's been blanket coverage on our website and just about every website in the United Kingdom this week. The Brexit vote and your lead story this week looks at the UK's future participation in European Union research and student mobility programmes.
That's right. Most immediately following the Brexit vote, Universities UK held a board meeting on Friday morning, and there were two main priorities identified, I gather. The first was to reassure EU nationals who are in the UK as staff or students and those set to arrive in the near future that their status and right to be in the country won't be affected by the result. And we've seen Jo Johnson sort of move to offer exactly that reassurance this week. Although he is kind of unable to give the picture in the long term, obviously, because we don't know what status the UK will have, but his words are that there will be no immediate change for EU students and staff in terms of their status. Mm. And the other key priority identified by the UK board was to lobby the government to secure associated country status in the EU's research funding programmes. This is obviously very key for British universities because they currently gain around £1.2 billion in EU research funding, and also that research funding brings sort of vital access to international networks of researchers within the EU. So that question of associated country status will be a very important one. We do see already, as it stands, non-EU members such as Norway and Turkey taking part in Horizon 2020 as associated countries. So it's likely that these talks over Horizon 2020 will be taking part as part of the government's broader negotiations with the EU as regards to the country's future relationship. Mm. But we've seen today that leaders of the EU have said the UK can't have access to the single market without signing up to freedom of movement. So would there be a question about whether the UK would be able to take part in Horizon 2020 and Erasmus without signing up to freedom of movement? Countries like Turkey will do that at present without signing up to freedom of movement. But on the other hand, the UK is kind of in a unique position in currently being within the EU and then possibly trying to become an associated member. Mm. The EU may not have the most friendly attitude towards a nation trying to do that.
No, and it's almost in the interest, isn't it, of the EU to make the UK suffer to some extent. I mean, there's fear. We've had Martin Paul writes in the blog section, he's the president of Maastricht University, he writes this week, about how, you know, there is a growing sort of right-wing sentiment in some other European countries as well, and they will be rallying and calling for these kind of referendums to take place in their own countries. If the UK was able to quickly negotiate a sweet deal, best of both worlds, it would surely give some momentum to those calls, and that's just not in the EU's interest.
Yeah, the EU emphatically will want to discourage any other nations from trying to leave and make the process as bloody and hard for the UK as it can. And so Sarah Main, the director of the Campaign for Science and Engineering, made a point along those lines, saying that there's no precedent for an EU member to leave and then try and become an associated member. This is the aspect for universities is going to be driven by bigger political forces, how easy or difficult EU member states wish to make it for the UK to exit and negotiate back into a fairly favourable position. So, as you said, the issues are bigger than science and research alone, but they are going to have a real impact on science.
Yes, I mean, there's uncertainty over whether the UK will continue in these big EU research programmes. Jo Johnson can't really say anything beyond immediately nothing changes. But it already seems to be having an effect. I mean, there's some academics and some European academics saying, well, the uncertainty is just simply too great to launch joint bids for European research funding from the Horizon 2020 programme, because it's true at the moment that no rules have changed. I mean, the UK is still in the EU. It therefore has access to all these big pots of money like Horizon 2020. But if you think the UK might be out of the EU by, well, we just don't know, next few years, who knows, and then there's uncertainty after that, then these grants are already really competitive and a lot of work. Why would you enter alongside a UK academic? There are other people saying, no, we're still going to continue to bid with UK colleagues, but it does already seem to be having an impact.
And then on top of that, when I spoke to the head of the League, or the Secretary General of the League of European Research Universities, he made the point that negotiations for the next EU research programme, the successor to Horizon 2020, which ends in 2020, which is Framework Programme 9, those negotiations are going to be starting soon, so the UK is going to need to try and be involved in those talks about the next round of the next research funding programme without having any idea about what its future relationship with the EU will be.
I mean, away from these nuances, it must be a terrible time to be an EU national in a UK university at the moment, be that as a student or an academic, which you referenced when you started talking about our lead story there. I mean, another blog just to draw your attention to, you can find all these on the Times Higher Education website. We had Nadine Muller from Liverpool John Moores University writing, a German national, worked in the UK academic sector for about 20 years. She said she was scared the safety net of the EU has disappeared in a country that she says has steadily mainstreamed racism, xenophobia and a deluded sense of self-importance. So some strong opinions being voiced. And Chris, I know you covered in this week's magazine as well as online, the universities where a lot of students seem to be feeling similarly sort of put out. So a lot of students come from EU countries, in some places as many as one in five. It's not doing wonders for the reputation of UK institutions overseas, all this, is it?
No, I think the point that David makes about the uncertainty that all of this creates is a very important one. In the immediate aftermath of the results being announced, and indeed, you know, since then, this week, we've seen a succession of universities coming out and sort of offering assurances about fee levels. Currently, EU students pay the same as home undergraduates. You might think that if we leave the EU, they would move on to the international student rate, which would be significantly higher. So, yeah, we have seen universities coming and saying, oh, well, for 16, 17, potentially 17, 18, and indeed in the case of Goldsmiths, University of London, 2018-19, that fee levels will be held at UK levels. I mean, the issue is, on two fronts, that only goes so far. I think the key issue probably is access to students' loans funding, because whatever levels your fees are at, if in the event of the UK actually exiting the EU, students are no longer able to get student loans, you know, whether it's, you know, 9,000 or 12,000 becomes, well, not quite academic, but heading in that direction, because you're not going to be able to get a loan for it, presumably, unless some sort of special access or reciprocal agreement is agreed. But also,
or unless you've got lots of money, in which case we just end it with
or indeed you've got lots of money. But also, it's not just about funding; it's about, again, the message that is sent out. If you're a student, you've got more universities on the continent teaching in English. You've got US, Australia, Canada, looking to expand their international student sectors. Are you going to come to a country which Michael Arthur, the president of UCL, told me was starting to look rather insular and inward-looking?
Indeed. David, how concerning is it, do you think, and I know this is something you've been looking into, how concerning is it that academics seem to be so out of kilter with the rest of the UK when it came to this referendum? We had a poll in the build-up that suggested 9 out of 10 were voting to remain. I know you wrote a blog about how disengaged, if you like, academics were becoming from the sort of the public at large. It's a concern, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, when we're sort of taking reaction on Friday morning, we were trying to digest what this all meant. I spoke to James Wilson, who's director of policy impact engagement at University of Sheffield Social Science Faculty, and he was saying, "Well, okay, there's all these big questions over students and research programs. You know, there's all these kind of concrete questions, but actually," he was kind of more shocked by the gulf that this vote seems to have exposed between people in universities and the general public, between and voters. And he said, saying, well, universities really need to ask themselves, and academics need to ask themselves, why is it that 90% of people who work in universities seem to want to stay, and yet a majority, a very slim majority, but still a majority, want to leave the EU? I guess there's two ways you could look at this. You know, you could say academics are kind of out of touch. They're part of a kind of establishment, as some leave campaigners have implied. Or you could say the opposite view and say they're just, they're better informed about politics. You know, who is right here? But I think it's going to cause some real consternation, because universities have really try to emphasize how, in the jargon, embedded they are in their communities, and they do lots of outreach events. And
not to mention the focus on impact of the last 10 years,
yeah,
where you're supposed to be able to show that what you do is...
Yeah. And to be honest, this result completely blows that to pieces. I mean, how can campuses be... the people on campuses, and students as well, are very pro-Remain as well. They do seem to have very different opinion from lots of bits of the country that voted 70-80% to leave the EU.
If only we'd hit Tony Blair's 50% in university target, then we might have got a very different result in the referendum.
Yeah, one of the biggest predictors of Remain result was whether someone has a degree, and it's clear, you look at the exit polling data, and Leave voters are very negative about things like immigration, multiculturalism, globalisation, and the internet as well. It's all these things have had having a force for ill. But these are the things that vice chancellors and universities have really emphasised over the past 10 years, especially with lots of international students on campus. They've sort of said, this is a sort of global campus, people from all over the world. The kind of perception of immigration and multiculturalism on campus is completely different from what it is in large parts of the country. Do university academics need to therefore somehow change their opinions, or do they need to communicate what they think is good about immigration across the country more, or do they need more academics from working class backgrounds, from communities that are much more likely to vote Leave? I mean, it's a really serious issue, and I think we're going to have more on this next issue.
We looked at the idea of the EU referendum as a graduates v non-graduates battle before the vote, and what came out from speaking to John Curtis, so one of the UK's leading polling experts, he did see that as a key divide, and said it was basically about graduates who are comfortable with globalisation and don't feel their jobs are under threat from immigration, versus people with lower levels of education who feel exactly the opposite, who work in probably lower skill jobs where they do feel that their wages or their jobs are under pressure from immigration and globalisation. So it's about two different takes on globalisation, graduates v non-graduates.
I suppose the question is, are graduates positive towards immigration and globalisation because something they've been taught at university, that sort of vibe they've got from being at university for 3 years has sort of taught them to be positive about this and given them a particular point of view? Or is it simply because they still have jobs and those jobs are probably under less pressure from Eastern European migrants than other people? So if graduates start to suddenly, as they are, go into much lower skilled jobs, do they then become more pro leave? Is it an economic or is it a cult? Are universities transforming graduates economically or culturally?
Unsurprisingly, we have overrun slightly on this issue. There's so much more to discuss, and it is indeed being discussed on timeshighereducation.com. Search for the referendum on there and you'll get all of these stories plus many, many more. Before we go, we must, John, come back to you very quickly about the Times Higher Education's inaugural Asia University Summit, which you attended out in Hong Kong. Some great interviews online. Who can we expect to hear from?
So online we've got video interviews with Thomas Rosenbaum, the Caltech president, Steve Kang, president of the Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology, and David Willetts, the UK's former Universities and Science Minister, and they're covering sort of a really interesting range of subjects: why Caltech's risen to its preeminent place in the world, the challenges of providing more creativity in education in Korea in contrast to the sort of Confucian traditions of rote learning, and David Willetts talking about Chinese universities being likely to establish branch campuses in the UK.
Indeed, all of those interviews are in full in video form and indeed as standard news coverage on our website. Just search for the names that have just been mentioned. Before I go, there was one other results night last week that was a little bit forgotten. We held our Higher Education Leadership and Management Awards on Thursday night, the Thelmas. Congratulations to Swansea University, which took home the Outstanding Leadership and Management Team Award. There were many more winners on the night too. They're all online and a number of incriminating photographs are also available on our Flickr stream, so do search for those. And that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to discuss anything that we've mentioned on today's episode, you can do so on our site. You'll find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed and on LinkedIn and Facebook too. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.